This 45-minute message is titled The Significance of Mutations by Reverend Walter Lang. It was originally given in 1987. For more materials by Reverend Walter Lang, please go to www.creationism.org/Lang. That's L-A-N-G, Lang.
This is the program Walter Lang, and the afternoon program is called The Significance of Mutations, and Walter Lang has been a longtime member of Bible Science Association, a past president, and very, very influential in its future.
Okay, thank you. Then you want me to use this mic? All right, thank you. Does it clip?
Yeah,
I'll clip it on then right away. I'm really not any longer with the Bible Science Association. Actually, the Bible Science Association has been dissolved in its old form with the way we developed it. It's really a completely new organization now, which is fine. And we're working in another organization because we feel there are new needs. I think we're in a whole new age of creationism. And having been in it so long, I'm one of the pioneers in today's creationism. I guess I can see that more clearly than others can. And so we're in what we call the Genesis Institute now. And if you haven't been to our book table, most of you have. It's over in the book. We'd be glad to give you our current magazine called The Ark Today. With us, we're working in the area of getting Bible and science more intimately together, trying to totally get rid of the prejudices that Bible is not a book of science or that somehow the other religion, especially Christian religion, ruins the objectivity of science and somehow or the other the science ruins the spirituality of the church. We're trying to overcome those prejudices totally. And we're finding that we're making tremendous results and tremendous progress that way, much more than we would otherwise. So that's where we stand today. One of the things that we're doing right now, we just decided to, we've been having Christmas activities at Grand Canyon for about 10 years in a row, pretty much. And one year we had a Christmas activity at Glen Rose, Texas instead. We had some real bad weather that time, a lot of ice and snow. But we're going to try it again at Christmas at Glen Rose this year because Glen Rose is getting more and more significant with its footprints, and now we find the Child's Tooth there fossilized along with the footprints. So it's getting more interesting all the time. So, and then we're emphasizing what we call creation evangelism worldwide. Today we're talking about mutations, and I have a little problem there that I've had for years, and that is I find the word mutations, it was used that way again last night, especially by the evolutionists last night, that mutations can be productive. That, you know, they would admit that most mutations are harmful. They'll say maybe 1 in 1,000 is good. Well, they say if there's 1 in 1,000 that's productive, then with millions of years, that could even develop new things and be productive. Our contention is that a mutation does come from, does bring about a change from the environment, but it's either a conservative change, not producing anything new, just conserving what's already there that wants to get destroyed, or it's a harmful change. If I throw my watch on the cement floor, it'll mutate, but it'll hardly turn to a helicopter. And no matter how many times I throw it on the cement floor, it still won't turn to a helicopter. So the change there is really a harmful one. And my contention among the creationists is that we oughtn't use the word mutation for anything beneficial. We should, as we're developing a whole new science now, we should restrict the use of the word mutations just to that which is harmful or conservative, but totally stay away from that which is productive. Our contention is that if there are changes and they adapt to the environment that are productive. We used to work at a camp out in Idaho quite a bit, north of the Galena Summit in what we call the Alps of Idaho, a place called Camp Perkins. And the ranger would take us back in the mountains, and then he would show us the different ecosystems as you climbed higher on the mountain. You'd had one ecosystem down below, maybe 1,000 feet up, you'd have another one, another 1,000 feet, you'd have another ecosystem. And this shows what remarkable adaptation to the environment we do find in nature. Now, the evolutionists like to say the environment produced that. And I want to show now that I think that's impossible. I want to explain why I think that's impossible. And yet there is that adaptation to the environment, see? And my contention is that the information for that was built in at creation already. And then it's been handed down in recessive genes down through generations. And then when the Lord is ready, He takes the recessive gene. We can do it somewhat, but not like the Lord. He'll take out that recessive gene and make it dominant, and then the organism adapts to the environment. But that's not a change from the environment then. That's my point. That's a change already built in. Now, the way I can illustrate that, if I put a rock in the ground and fertilize and water it, it'll never produce a corn plant. You got to take a corn seed and plant it in the ground, because the information has to already be in there before it'll produce a corn plant. Now, you can take corn seed and crossbreed them, and, oh, we get up to 200, you know, bushels per acre up there in northern Iowa where we have our school. And that, if conditions are right, that isn't at all impossible. But you couldn't do that with a rock. No matter how much environment you give it, how much favorable environment you give it, a rock would never produce a corn plant because the information isn't built in for it. So when you find changes in nature that are productive and that adapt to the environment, we don't want to make the false premise that the men made last night again on the evolution side, as if the environment could produce that, see? That's why I don't think we should use the word mutation for that productive change that we note. We should rather restrict the word mutation just for the harm or the conservatism that the environment will produce. The environment will produce an injury, and the environment will produce a conservative factor. But it cannot bring anything new in. That's my point. It cannot bring anything. So I think we should try to restrict that word mutations on, among us, especially among us creationists, and then use another word for the productive changes that already have been built in from creation. Let's try to explain that with a number of illustrations, and I suppose we could give all kinds of them. Then I think of the Urey Miller experiment, whereby he claimed that he had produced amino acids, what he thought it was an accidental way. And I will admit that nature seemingly can produce amino acids in what seems to be a random way. But you see, to preserve it, he had to trap it out. That's not random anymore when you trap something out. See, that's using intelligence. And it's no longer a random process. It's no longer anything that nature automatically does. And therefore, I don't think you can use that as an illustration that nature can produce these amino acids on its own. Of course, what it does when it does produce them, it's only because information is already there to do that. Now, several years ago, Wilder Smith was lecturing at Chuck Smith's church down there in Costa Mesa, California, and I've lectured there several times too already, that church. And he had a rather dramatic lecture discussing the debate between Wilberforce and Huxley. You remember that famous debate in England between Huxley and Wilberforce, where Wilberforce more or less was trying to defend creationism and Huxley was defending evolution. And seemingly the science world has always felt that that was the end of creation next to the Scopes trial, and that Wilberforce was roundly defeated there. Well, see, Huxley suggested that if there were, 100 monkeys on 100 typewriters, and if they could type a million years, finally, accidentally, they would produce the Lord is my shepherd, you know. And I guess Wilberforce didn't quite know how to answer. I'm just quoting Wilder Smith right now. And then the answer is that every time a monkey would get one letter accidentally, he'd lose it three times faster than he'd get a new one, see? Because, see, when amino acids are made in a random way in nature, they're destroyed two or three times faster than they're made. So you never get anywhere. You go backward more than going forward, see? You see, this is the power of randomness. it isn't that productive power that our university world tries to make it, but it really is either a conservative or mostly a harmful power rather than a productive power. And so I think we should recognize that what Uri Miller did demanded thought. It demanded information. He had to trap it out before he could preserve those amino acids and do anything with them. Otherwise, they'd have been destroyed two or three times faster than they were made. Then I've been on the Galapagos Islands. We had a tour there in 79. And I've seen all the variety that Darwin said, except now when they, you know, when the people got in there, they left their pigs and their dogs go wild. And they've destroyed most of the Galapagos tortoises and most of the, not most, but a large number of the iguanas. I was disappointed not to see it. I expected these swarms of iguanas, and I just saw a few. Well, they were there, but they weren't anything like they used to be. And the only tortoises I saw was in the Darwin Station in captivity. It's unfortunate. And then they had a big fire here last year on those islands, too, and I don't know what that all destroyed. Well, I think in general, though, I saw it pretty much the way Darwin saw it back in 1835. And, of course, when he saw it, he noticed the unique varieties on the island. There's about 12 endocrine varieties that supposedly aren't found anywhere else, like flightless cormorants. I don't know whether... I got fooled on these cactus trees. I thought that was unique. But then I saw cactus trees in southern Mexico last year, you know, on the other side of the mountains. And there's a whole bunch of cactus trees right between... Phoenix and Flagstaff. You know, as you travel the road, there's a whole bunch of cactus trees in there, too. So I guess I have to take that back. Not that unique to the islands. But then I saw this flagrant bird that where the male, you know, puts out its red pouch to attract the female. That's kind of unique and different. And then, of course, penguins. Now, normally penguins are either in the Arctic or Antarctic, but even though this is on the equator, the cold Humboldt current comes up there and makes it possible for penguins to be found on these islands, which is really quite unique for penguins to be found on the equator, you see. And a lot of boobies, all kinds of boobies, they're quite unique too. Now, Darwin particularly was enamored with the finches, of course, because he noticed that the finches were different on different islands and on different elevations, either on beak size or other things. And being a fairly careful observer, he noted that, and he says, well, it must be the different islands or the different elevations that produce these little slight variations in the finches. And he'd been reading quite a bit about evolution. You know, he had finished his training to be a pastor. But he'd also been taught by... the people at the seminary that a perversion of Linnaeus's fixity of species. Now, in his early year, Linnaeus did teach that maybe all the different kinds of dogs were made just as they are now during creation week. And all the different kinds of horses were made just as they are now, even openly during creation week. And that was taught pretty much as a Bible truth when Darwin went to the seminary. And then when he saw this variety here and different places and could see that it developed, then he felt the Bible was wrong. He didn't realize he had been taught the Bible improperly. Because even when Linnaeus died, he didn't accept that anymore. It was just in his earlier years that he thought of this idea of the fixity. It's because he was a great classifier. So then seeing these finches especially, along with all the other variety that we see on these islands, intrigued him and helped him develop his what we call Darwinism ideas of things developing a slow process from the influence of nature through natural selection and time and environment. It is true, though, and I think I have to grant that when you get in isolation, these are pretty well isolated islands. You do the variety that I say is built in from creation week on. That variety comes out more fully than it would where you don't have that isolation. I'll grant that isolation has something to do with unique varieties, but I won't admit that those bleak volcanic islands produced that. See, that I won't admit. That was already coded before, long before those islands, that, you know, ever were there, maybe even. And then when God is ready, it takes His intellect to do it. Sometimes we can do it. I mean, we can cross things and get the information out. We can cross sweet peas. We can cross birds. We can cross animals and get a certain amount of variety, but only because the information is already there. But then God can do it, of course, much better than we can. And when He's ready, He can pull out this recessive gene, make it dominant, and then adapt to the environment. But I would rebel strongly against any idea that those islands, those bleak islands, could have produced that frigate bird with the big pouch, or even produced all those little varieties in the finches. I can't see how those bleak volcanic islands... They only have about 10 inches of rain there a year, see? It's quite a dry area. And it just seems rather impossible to me that you can do it that way. Now, when you come to Archaeopteryx, maybe, say, 6 years ago, Dr. Thrope, from a creationist from Israel, he was teaching at the Beersheba University down in the desert, wrote me an article by a colleague of his, Dr. Spentner, a research biologist there in Israel who originally is from St. Louis, Missouri, who was rather dubious about Archaeopteryx. Remember those two doctors, I forget their last name right now, that found those fossils, a father and son, each made over $1 million on each fossil. And he was rather dubious. There's something wrong that they made that much money on those fossils. So, as a scientist, he went to the museum in Berlin, where one of them is, and studied it quite carefully, and he was quite convinced that they had minutely scraped out the bones and pasted the wings on. And he wrote that up. And I think we carried it in the Bible Science newsletter. It's been since carried also in the Creation Research Society magazine. And then lately, you know, Sir Ferdinand Hoyle and that Indian, I can never pronounce his name, that's his colleague, they went to the London Museum where the other fossil is. And they were convinced of the same thing when they studied that fossil. Even though the museum, both museums, strongly deny it, you know. Well, I don't know. But it appears to me that maybe even this fossil is a hoax. Most others are. I find that the Piltdown man, of course, turned out to be a hoax. Nebraska man turned out to be a hoax. As far as I'm concerned, the Peking man is a hoax. And Java man, yeah, maybe you don't know it, but Dubois gave up on that before he died. I have first-hand information on that. He called it all eight before he died. And as far as Syngenthropus is concerned, our men down in Los Angeles actually heard Leakey before he died, Louis Leakey, admit, because of Homo habilis, that he'd given up on Syngenthropus and called it all eight. So maybe Archaeopteryx is in that classification too. Here lately, they're trying to tell me that our footprints, now just as an aside, because I'm involved in this, that our footprints down in Glen Rose are hoaxes. But we've proven them dead wrong, because we've found a whole bunch more since they started that. We've found some more footprints in October. We found some more footprints in January. And now we found a child's tooth, clearly a child's tooth. No question about it. Every dentist we show it to, without any hesitancy, points this out as a child's tooth fossilized right by the dinosaur footprints. There's no question about it as far as we're concerned. I just came from there. We have tremendous first-hand information on that. But you see, the evolutionists won't admit it because it destroys their religion too much. So maybe also Archaeopteryx might also be a hoax, but even if it isn't, there are birds that have claws and there are birds that have teeth. They're not all without it. And the wings are very advanced wings. Now, if this was a intermediary fossil, why would the wings be so advanced? They're the most advanced wings you can find, see? And that's a problem, too. Now, I think maybe I should say a little more about the second law. We have the two laws of thermodynamics, maybe three, that we use quite a bit in physics. One is that if energy is converted, it's never really lost. You might lose its usefulness. If you burn up a chair, for example, the energy is there yet, but you might not be able to sit on that chair anymore. It's just turned into another form But the energy hasn't been lost, but neither can energy be added to. You can't either destroy or add to energy. Well, of course, that tends to make evolution impossible, because evolution would almost demand that energy needs to be developed. Then the second law is that when energy is converted, normally it runs down rather than up, that normally it goes into disorder rather than into more order. For instance, if you had a Chinese checkerboard with all the Chinese checkers in place and you'd hit it from the bottom, it wouldn't play the game in a random way, see? But the marbles would get all out of order. And the more you hit it from the bottom, the more disorderly the marbles, rather than playing the game, would be. The only way you can play the game is if you put information in. Your information would move those marbles, see? That's the only way you can play the game. You can't play it by a random process, by hitting the board from the bottom. You can't play the game that way. So the second law says that when you have a random process like that, it normally goes to disorder rather than normally going to order. Things do run down. Now, a second definition. There are a lot of our creationists who are rebelling against, saying it's totally the result of sin. Problem is that too many people are afraid to bring spirituality into science. We find it very valuable. Well, it's a problem, I grant that, trying to figure out just how to explain the second law. So, another fellow by the name of Robert Ganges, I don't know if I pronounced his name right, Ganges or Ganges, he's quite a prominent scientist in Jersey. He helped invent the color television. He has a big laboratory of 300 people working in his laboratory. He's quite a prominent man in the whole invention area. He's become a creationist to a point, and a very, I'd say, a strong Christian, a good Bible student. He still has the long ages in his mind and a number of other things yet that we have left. He hasn't yet, but I like his definition of the second law maybe even better than these other two definitions I just gave, and that is, to him, the second law is the lack of information. If you plant a rock in the ground, it won't produce a corn plant, because the information isn't in there to do that. If you plant a corn seed in the ground, it will produce a corn plant, because the information is in that seed to do that, see? There's a lot of building information in the universe and in nature that we've got to face. Now, we didn't know 125 years ago that there was all this information in the cell, see, that we find in the coding, in the DNA and the RNA. Now we're finding it all through the cell, in the mitochondria and the enzymes, in the ribosomes, and in the cytoplasm, in all the different parts of the live cell we're finding coding today. So maybe there's a whole lot more information in nature. We're beginning to find a little more in the atom now. And when I read the book of Job, and I study this as a science book, it is the prime science book in the Bible. There's a lot more science information there than even in Genesis. I find that there's information in the weather, as haphazard as the weather might seem to us. It says very clearly there's information in that weather. Now, maybe it's God directing it directly, or maybe he has built-in information that we haven't even begun to find. In fact, it says in Job 38 that rain is a father and ice is a mother. Now, I don't take that as allegory, as many students who take the Bible loosely do. No, that's a scientific statement. As all statements in the Bible are absolutely perfect, they never make a mistake scientifically. I challenge anybody to show me a scientific mistake in the Scriptures. It's just not there. And I worked at it for 27 years now. So I take that seriously. And I wouldn't be surprised that we will find some genetic qualities in the weather we haven't found yet. So there's a great deal of built-in information that God put in already at creation, you see? So maybe that's the best way to describe that second law, like Ganges does. That it, whenever you have things going down to disorder, it's the lack of information. So if things do improve, it's only because information is already somehow or the other built in from creation. And then when God is ready, he takes something that's recessive or whatever it is, and then pulls it out and makes it dominant and operative. So I think that's an important thing to remember. Now, I don't want to go in, because I'm supposed to do this tomorrow, I don't want to go in detail to the difference between creation and preservation. But I want to mention it just briefly, so you know what I'm talking about. And tomorrow we want to go into it in detail. And that is this, that I'm convinced that when God says it is finished, Genesis 2:1, he materially means that. That he hasn't created another single thing since the 6 days of creation in a material way. He created everything with either already developed or the power and information built in to develop when he's ready. And then that's handed down. And there's now obviously, if we're restricted to preservation laws in nature today, obviously there's no way by studying nature that we can find the creation laws. That's very obvious. If they're all finished in Genesis 2:1, then you can't study them. So the only way you can get at it is realize the weakness of trying to explain that nature got here by itself, and then wonder if there isn't something in the Bible which is above nature that would give us an understanding that we can't get from nature. And that's what I found. And I find that I can explain the variety in nature more satisfactorily that way than anything else I've come up with, that God used a separate process to make the world. I remember one time I was in Portland, Oregon, and I was helping the Griffiths there. They used to be in charge of a creation movement in Portland, Oregon, Dean Griffiths. I was in their home helping them do some mailing, and the television was on, and sure enough, here came Dwayne Gish debating with, I think, Moyer, if I'm not mistaken, not the one in Boulder, Colorado, but one out on the East Coast. And what amazed me was that as they were going along, it was a half-hour debate, Moyer said, you know, Dwayne Gish, I'm surprised you believe in change. I thought only we evolutionists believed in change. And of course, Dwayne Gish answered by saying, well, we believe in the changes we can observe, not in those we can't observe, you see. And then in 1977, I was in Hawaii again. I've been there 17 times, one way or the other, either leading tours or lecturing. And I was in Hilo, and I was working with a Christian school there. And they wanted me to get in with the biology professor at the University Extension, Dr. Baldwin. He was also a rector at the Episcopal Church. And he thought he could refute any creationist. We have one medical doctor there who lectures on creation. He thought he had refuted him. So he was more than happy to be there. So I was with him all day. Now, the students stayed until noon, and then they walked out, because all he could do was find something wrong with the Bible. I mean, he didn't bring in the data from nature. All he was doing was attacking the Bible all the time. And they were getting tired of that, so they just walked out about noon. Well, we stayed there till 3 and 4 in the afternoon with him. And then finally, about 2 o'clock, he says, you know, I'm surprised at you. I didn't think you believed in change. He didn't think any. He thought creationists didn't believe in any change at all. Again, I told him the same thing. I said, we believe in all the changes we can observe. It's the ones we can't observe that bother us. We'll accept all the change that we see. It's what we don't see that bothers us. And that's, again, the reason I think we should be concerned to use that word mutation rather carefully and not use it too widely, but use it only for that which either harms or conserves the organism. And that's about all that nature can do, all about all the environment can do. It really can't produce anything. We have a problem with what we call science. Now, as I study the book of Job, and I've been at it almost 4 years now very intensively, we're doing our final typesetting now, I find a statement that you have in the 28th chapter, in the wisdom chapter, in the 28th verse, where it says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Now, many of my colleagues have said that's not science. And there are statements in the book of Job that would seem to support their contention. Because, see, in chapter 16, or the 12, Job says that you can learn from the birds and the beasts and the fishes. He says, go to the birds and the beasts and the fishes and learn. And that's what science for us today really does. It goes to the birds, the beasts, and the fishes, and it learns in a rigorous way. And Job describes that rigorousness that we have in science today, the way the miners find gold and silver and copper and iron and precious jewels in the 28th chapter in the first 11 verses. And I don't find anything in science today more rigorous than what I see those miners did back 4,000 years ago. They were so rigorous that they could overturn a mountain without explosives, believe it or not. They were that rigorous in looking for gold and silver and copper and iron and precious stones. And that's really what the name of the game is in science today, that you'll be very rigorous, very disciplined in looking for whatever the secrets of nature have for us. Then he asks the question. Job describes that rigorousness in the first 11 verses of 28, the wisdom chapter. Then he asks the question whether you can find wisdom that way. Now, the young man who came to Job later, he later on said there is an information above the beads and the birds and the fishes. There's something that you can learn that goes above what you get out of the observations from nature. Now, it depends on what you want to call science, see? Our science world today doesn't want to call that which is above the beasts, birds, and fishes. It doesn't want to call that science. I think that's a mistake. I think we should realize that we're making a mistake when we restrict science to only what you can learn from the birds and the beasts and the fishes. I think you need a science above, and I'll explain what I mean. Because then he asked the question, if you can find wisdom in the birds, the beasts, and the fishes, if you can find wisdom in copper, gold, iron, silver, precious stones, can you find wisdom in any element of nature? And the answer is an emphatic no. Absolutely, categorically, an emphatic no. And then, of course, he has to give them an idea, well, where can you find wisdom? And then in the very last verse, he says, the gospel fear of God, because he's witnessing to his friends about the gospel in this wisdom chapter. The gospel fear of God, that will give you wisdom. And then it'll also give you moral understanding. Now, in the wisdom literature in the Bible, that includes Job, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes especially, also the Songs, but that's not significant right now. It's in the Songs. That's in another category. There are four words for wisdom that are significant. There's this word, chokmah, and it... I'm spelling it. Am I spelling it right? No. I transliterate this way. That's one word. And then right, that means wisdom in general. Then under that comes being. And that reminds us of what we sometimes call our head, our being up here. It actually comes from the Hebrew. It means perception. It's distinguished as perception. You know, getting the understanding of things. Then there's another word under there called segel. And that means prudence. So we keep a balanced mind that we don't go to extreme one side or the other. See? Paul, when he writes to Timothy and Titus, says, be sober-minded. And he means to be segel, to be prudently minded. Keep a balance always in your thinking. And then the bottom word is data. And that's where we get our data from. That's actually the Hebrew word, see? And we just took it over in our language. And that, of course, means what Job was speaking of, when you can get information from the birds and the beasts and the fishes, see? That's what he was speaking of. And that's really what they brag about in science today. They claim they restrict themselves just to data, see? Well, now, we have four times that this word, this statement is made in the wisdom literature. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The basic passage is Job 28:28. That's where it started. Job wrote that 4,000 years ago, and the others are later. Then, in Psalm 111:10, we have it again, I think, down. So, that he took it out of Job, though. Then we have it in Proverbs 1:7, and again, that's Solomon, and he took it out of Job. And then we have it again in Proverbs 9:10. Now, these three times, here, it's this word, chokmah, that's used. But this one time, it's this word that's used, data. Now, this is the gospel fear of God, because that's what Job is doing. He's witnessing to his friends about the gospel. And that means that the gospel, the very heart of our Christian religion, is basic to good data, to good understanding of the data, or data, or however you want to pronounce it. You know, I'm pronouncing it the Hebrew way. And it isn't separate or above it. It's basic to it. In the book of Job, and I'm concentrating on Job because I do think it gives a superior understanding of science, you find there that... First of all, Job was highly blessed. He was probably the most righteous man in the Bible outside of Christ himself because, first of all, he's called perfect right at the beginning of the chapter. And then God calls him perfect twice when he's confronted with Satan. And then he was called the greatest man of the East also. Now, then God permitted Satan to take all his blessings away, including his health and his children and all of his goods. And then three friends came to comfort him, if you recall, and they were brilliant. I would call them Nobel Prize winners and top theologians today. Way ahead of most of our Nobel Prize winners, because most of the Nobel Prize winners are not Christian. I mean, they're not, they don't base their science on the gospel or on Christ. These did. Not on Christ, but at least they were religious. Very strongly religious. And they wouldn't have the paganism that I see in the science world today. But they didn't have the gospel. And so their answer to Job's problem was that Job must have committed some secret sin. And they looked upon his problems as punishments. And if we look at God's power in nature in its bare way, without knowing the love of God, that's the way it appears to us. And that's why so many turn away from God, because they can't understand how a good God could make this world and then permit all this evil, like he permitted the devil to take all the blessings away from Job. Why did he do that? Doesn't that make God immoral? That's the way a lot of people... That's the way Job believed. He finally came up with the idea that God wasn't fair. And he wanted a legal confrontation with God. Now, what I'm getting at is then, whereas Satan had the wrong answer, he said Job was righteous only because God had given him these outward blessings. Where the friends were wrong, they said it was a punishment. And Job had committed some secret sin to bring this on. And where Job is wrong when he accused God of injustice. Then Job was correct when he led his friends to the gospel. But then there was a young man there that most people don't understand in the book who led Job deeper into the love of God. And when he did that, that quieted Job down. Then he could censure him in love. And then God could help out with the whirlwind talks. This shows the power of love also in science itself. That's why you don't only have the fear of God, you have the gospel fear of God. That's the beginning of Chokmah, or the beginning of Dad, or the beginning of these two also. And then not only when you have God, not only to his punishing power, not only to his sovereign power, but to his loving power, the power in the gospel. We haven't even begun to realize science in that direction, not even as Christians yet. We're afraid to bring science into the gospel that we might ruin its spirituality. The average statement that I get when I've gone around these 27 years is, I believe in the six-day creation, so what? Why do you bother me? We haven't begun to realize the power we have as Christians in science. That's my point. Now let's begin to realize that. Let's begin to use it. And it's got to come from us Christians, because the unbelievers don't know the gospel. Just like these friends didn't know the gospel. They can't help us. They can't even help science in that way, see? But we can. And that's why I say, even if the science world doesn't use the word mutation properly, at least we should. We should take the lead and realize it's our responsibility as Christians to use that word in the right way. I'm not so much worried what the university world does. I'm worried about what we Christians are doing. That's where it's got to start. It's not going to start with the university world. It's got to start with us as Christians. That's where it's got to start. Yeah, let's take some questions first, and then we'll see. Yes, please, sir.
I read a article or a pamphlet now about the speed of light
change. Yeah, there's quite a dispute on that. I think Barry Satterfield has done a good work. He's, of course, based on somebody else's work again. Some of our men felt they found some discrepancy in some of his figures. So he went over all his figures again. And as far as I know, there was some fun. You see, Clifford Wilson and another fellow from Adelaide were just out last week with us at Glen Rose. See, so I asked them, you don't always get first-hand information out of Australia. That's 9,000 miles away or more. And so sometimes you don't always get the latest in information. But I understand he's revised his work and is more satisfied than ever, even after the challenge. You know, some challenge some of his mathematics. And it seems that way that... He has a point there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, if that is good data, mm-hmm. Showing that there is a possibility of lightning stars things and explain all these phenomena.
Well, that's what I told this gentleman, you know, that I mentioned this radioactive man at Pittsburgh last year. I said, yeah, I know when you look at the radioactive decay, it looks like you could find 4.5 billion years in there. I don't think you can, but it looks like it. And it looks like you could find 20 billion, 30 billion light years out in space. For instance, last April... An hour before the lecture, I heard Gingrich was going to lecture at the University of Minnesota. He's a top astronomer in Harvard, a Christian. In fact, He witnessed to Christ in his lecture. The room was full at the university there. But then he said, well, you know, according to my astronomy, I've got to allow for 20 billion light years. So then he tried to use the usual compromising of saying he could be a Christian and believe in the 20 billion light years at the same time. And I didn't get a chance to talk to Gingrich because I had to leave before the lecture was over. But I did talk to this other gentleman. And I said, you know, God, by a different process, could put those 20 billion light years in at once. And if there was this to this radioactive dating, I don't think there is, he could put it in at once. We shouldn't let that fool us because we should put the scriptures first. It's perfect, it's reliable, and we're discovering that more and more. And nature isn't that reliable because it's cursed. That's why you can never get final answers in nature. You can get consistency, but you can never get absolutes in nature. You got to make a distinction. If we couldn't get consistency, we might as well throw our sciences out. We couldn't have any science at all. There has to be a certain amount of consistency in nature to have science at all. But there certainly aren't absolutes. You got to go beyond nature to get absolutes. That's why I'm stressing this. Now, you see, even these friends who would be called top Christians today didn't understand. See? They were Nobel Prize winners. They were brilliant. In fact, they were Cro-Magnon young people as far as I'm concerned. And they had an intelligence. When you read the book of Job, it's almost all poetry, you know. And the most difficult poetry you can imagine, twice ahead of Shakespeare. Twice ahead of Shakespeare. You got to understand the poetry. It takes a while. Tremendous memory, yes.
Well, I was going to say, let's get back, getting back to mutations.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Isn't it more significant that when you have mutations that if you need more than one mutation in order to accomplish a change, then it becomes one mutation being not viable?
I'm trying to think of the man down in Los Angeles that wrote that book on the mathematical impossibility. Maybe some of you can remember his name. I can't think of his name. Good friend of mine, but I'm showing my age. My memory is beginning to give me quite a few problems now. Well, I can't think of his name, but he wrote a book. It's out of print now, unfortunately, that just shows the mathematical impossibility of not only, first of all, the amino acids, you know, forming accidentally, but then going on to polymer, and then going on to protein, and then into a live cell, and it just gets, you know, so mathematically great that it becomes a complete impossibility finally that could develop. That's right. Let's see. I believe you had your hand up back there first, ma'am. And that's where creation would still be going on, as I see it today, only in the gospel. Because, see, the Lord says we are a new creation when we accept Christ and his forgiveness. We're a new creation. So there's where creation would still be going on today, but only there, not in a physical way, except through that, see. In other words, there is no creation going on in a material way. Maybe Solomon stresses that a little different way when he says in Ecclesiastes 1:9, there's no new thing under the sun. Now, you got to know what under the sun means in the book of Ecclesiastes. See, Ecclesiastes is a difficult book because it doesn't seem to have any gospel in it on the surface, and it doesn't seem to have any spirituality in it on the surface. But you see, Solomon is restricting that book to material things when he says under the sun. He uses that word 23 times in 12 chapters. And it's a technical expression to show that as an earthly king, he is restricting himself to what he needs to do as an earthly king in earthly matters, see? So when he says there's no new thing under the sun, he means in a material way, not spiritual necessarily, but in a material way. And all the material things, with all the potential, were created in 6 days, and the word finished then really physically and literally means finished in Genesis 2:1, you see? Because of the separate process of creation.